Hi guys, welcome back to This Is Powerful. You're about to hear something a little different. Over the past year and a half on This Is Powerful, we've had some brilliantly honest conversations about addiction, recovery, resilience, and a lot of what comes in between. These kinds of conversations aren't usually had or heard, but should be. Certain moments really stayed with us. The ones that hit a nerve. The ones that made people feel a little less alone. So today, we're bringing some of those moments back. We have collected wise and wonderful clips from our top 10 episodes. We visit stories you can't forget and be hit with the reflections just as impactful as the first time you heard them. You'll hear from some guests who have been through adversity and come out the other side. These courageous characters have faced life's challenges head on. If you've been with us from the start, think of this as a chance to revisit the moments that mattered. And if you're new, you're about to get a crash course in what This Is Powerful is all about. I'm Paul Scholfer. You're listening to or watching This Is Powerful, and this is our top 10 countdown. Starting us off at number 10 is Sonia. When I accepted that I could be with myself, started enjoying my company, which is very weird for me. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's a powerful lesson to learn in recovery, right?
Oh, very powerful, very inspiring. I think, you know, on our journey and going to meetings and that fellowship, that gave me that. You know, I know with yourself going out for coffees after the meetings and having that community gave me that strength as well, where I could be attracted to somebody, but I knew that this, I'd committed to myself that I wanted to have this relationship and actually take that time out to get to know me. And like I said back then, the same with the chocolate, I would have fixed on anything to change the way that I felt, you know. So if someone was attracted to me, I knew deep down in my heart it was a way of me escaping me again. And I knew that I'd committed to me for the first time in my life, you know, and I knew that I wanted to stick with that, you know. And it's not always easy. It can be very lonely, but it's so, so worth it. You know, it's so, when I look at it now and I look at the woman that I am today, I can be attracted to certain people. But I look at today as well of where back then I didn't know what I wanted. I didn't know, you know, if you was good looking, or I didn't know what qualities, because I didn't actually have them qualities within myself. But through going through the program and doing that inner work, you know, the woman that sits here today, I'm able to say, you know, that I like myself. I know what I want today. And one thing that people that know, I will never settle, you know, just to have someone in my life that I can't sit with myself today.
Such a powerful thing you said about escaping yourself. And I remember someone saying to me, I said, I'm going to go to LA again. I'm going to move back there and get a house. And they said, that's fine, but you're still taking yourself. I thought, what do you mean by that? You know, and then when I arrived there, I got a lovely house and stuff. And I remember laying there on my bed thinking, yeah, I've still got my thoughts. I'm still with me. So you can fool yourself by surrounding yourself with shiny things. But unless you go inside and change your narrative and change what's going on, nothing else, nothing will work.
There's a great thing that I say, go within and you'll never go without. So it's a journey inwards. And yeah, there's another, what is it? You take your head with you. You know, I've been to myself many places and been in relationships, but like what you just said, Paul, the thoughts and the feelings, you know, of what I'm feeling, that no human power is ever going to be able to rescue me, you know. I'm the only person that can rescue me, that can do this work.
That was the brilliant and insightful Sonia. For more of this episode, check out season 2, episode 11. Number 9 is psychotherapist and addiction specialist Tana Hassan.
I think it's an individual journey. One guy in recovery I met, who's not a therapist, said to me, I know a lot of therapists that have relapsed because they stop looking at themselves because they've done group work or they've done therapy work. Just remember, they're two very separate. Your recovery is your recovery. What you do for a living is what you do for a living. And I was like, okay. And I kind of took that advice for a while. But then when I started my own practice, and I was working PAYE and I was doing my own practice, and I learned that because I saw psychiatrists doing that. They'd work at the NHS during the day and then they would do private treatment in the evening. And I thought, he's driving around a brand new Range Rover, why am I not doing that? That was my initial thought, right? That's not where I'm at now with that, but the sentiment was, I can, why not? And I love it. I'd miss the work, you know. So I'm in leadership management, but I want to be in the in that driving seat, helping that therapeutic value of one helping another, right? So, And I think it's not about balance. I think I call it, I learned from someone a while ago, it's about harmony, trying to reach harmony. If I'm saying balance, it suggests I'm on the tipping edge of something.
Interesting.
But harmony meaning that tomorrow might be 80% work and 20% play. Next week might be 70% work and 30% play. And it's just reviewing all the time, being fluid with it. You know, as Bruce Lee says, be like water, my friend.
Yeah.
You know, and I wasn't being like water. And it all become very constricting. And before I knew it, for a while, I stopped engaging in the things that's got me where I am today, right?
Yeah.
To a point where my wife said to me, you're the most depressive person to be around. And you have been for the last couple of years. I feel like you don't want us, like we're holding you back. That broke my heart when I heard that. And I thought what it was me putting my own pressure on myself, that money, property, prestige diverts from our primary purpose.
Mm.
And I was just giving myself a hard time. I'm not taking them where we are. And the cost of living, everything going up. I was a senior manager in the NHS, had my private practice. I'm thinking, why am I not? And it's like, well, we're doing all right. But it was just that more. To be honest, I got to be honest with you, isn't it? So there I am driving down the A12. And the thought was, if I drove into this wall off the road, my wife will get the payout and they'll all be all right. That was my thought. God, that makes me really emotional thinking about that. They'll be all right. And I thought, that's fucking wonky.
Yeah.
This is me in full-time employment, practicing as a therapist, clean. This is what my thinking is. I stopped picking up the phone. I stopped engaging. I stopped turning up on time. I stopped doing all the stuff that I was taught in the beginning. I was just holding on to what was. It was really dangerous and that frightened the shit out of me. And I went to a meeting and I just cried.
For more of the brilliant and honest therapist Tanahassan, check out season 2, episode 10. Number 8, we have the brilliant Dr. Federica Amati, who happens to be my wife.
When you drink alcohol, it sort of causes this inflammation all the way down as it goes down the esophagus, the stomach, and then into the gut, the liver, and then into gut. And essentially, it disrupts the microbiome. So the good, happy microbes, healthy microbes, that support the mucin layer production, that keep the immune system in balance, and that send helpful messages to the immune system, they don't like alcohol. It doesn't help them, ethanol or acetaldehyde, so both. And it also actually disrupts the barrier.
Mm-hmm.
So what can result from that, and you see this a lot in people who have sort of cirrhosis of the liver and who have been heavy drinkers for a long time, they have what's called leaky gut. So the gut, essentially, the barrier can't keep in the waste products that come from inside the gut, and they start to leak into the body and into the immune system.
Wow.
So you have this leaky gut situation, which then the body tries to clear, and guess which organ needs to try and clear this toxin, the toxins, is the liver. The liver's already overworked at this point. So the inflammation, the low-level inflammation, we know that inflammation is a key driver of cancer. And then again, the liver's suffering with this leaky gut as well. So it really, the gut is not happy with alcohol consumption. Now there's like probiotics coming to the market that promise to protect the gut when you drink. But honestly, some of the things that I always say when I
that
get
sounds
asked
like
by
putting a tiny little airbag in a big car.
Yeah, I mean, journalists say, like, what can people do? And I say, well, they can just drink less. Yeah. That's the best thing you can do. And then the other thing that seems to be like protective is to, if you're going to drink, drink with a meal. But you know, when you look at alcohol as a drug, like as a pharmaceutical drug,
so
they've calculated what the safe amount would be to consume before these neurotoxic, genotoxic effects, right? And it's 2 units a year.
Wow.
So
a year.
Because our bodies are really good at dealing with toxins.
Yeah.
Like we have, if we're lucky, if we're metabolically healthy as well, our bodies are really amazing at doing this. But this, we're talking about a substance that's genuinely harmful. And when you look at it, if you took a step back and you were to regulate this as a drug, 2 units a year.
When we first went for a meal in New York together and I wasn't drinking, I ordered you a espresso martini.
Yeah, that's right.
And he was like, do you want some? What did you think that I wasn't drinking?
I don't have any stigma attached to not drinking. For me, that's not... So for me, it's like, okay, you don't drink. It made me think, oh, actually, maybe I shouldn't have this espresso martini then. Because it had become... Living in New York had made sort of drinking... became this social thing.
Yeah.
So it was like, luckily, I didn't drink every day. But for a date or meeting someone new, it became like a normal thing.
Yeah.
And so you telling me that you didn't drink, I was like, oh, that's quite nice, actually, because then I don't have to drink either.
Which is such an amazing reaction.
So weird.
Because a lot of people would be like, oh, you're quite boring. I've heard this so many times. Oh, that's a shame.
But I'm so grateful that you don't drink, because thanks to the fact that you don't drink, I don't drink. Like we at home, like it doesn't occur to me to drink.
Never.
Why? Like, so I'm so glad that I married someone who doesn't drink. Our girls are growing up with a household where the parents don't drink.
To hear more about the truth about alcohol and the happy side when you have an alcohol-free house, check out season 3, episode 3. Number 7 is David Smallwood.
At 36, I had a fit from withdrawal from alcohol and drugs, and I was a salesman driving a car, so I couldn't drive.
Was this because you were trying to get off it yourself, David?
No, it was just... I knew I was working for a company, and I knew that I wasn't, you know, I just wasn't working. And I knew I was going to get the sack. So I decided to quit taking benzos, quit drinking, and quit smoking all at the same time.
Right.
And the net result was 2 days later, after getting the sack, I had a withdrawal fit. And was in hospital for 2 weeks. And then came out and thought, well, I've got to do something. I know, we'll get a pub. So, you know.
Good choice.
Got a pub, and I was in that trade for 10 years. Very successfully, because at the same time, I got recovery. You know, I went into the pub, like 3 months after getting in the pub, I was carted off to a psychiatric hospital. I woke up one morning with a consultant psychiatrist, a social worker, my brother and my wife, all looking at me going, what's going on? And I had a blackout and threatened my cleaning lady with a very sharp lock-back knife that I carried all the time, so I was frightened.
Yeah, that would get you put
locked in. Yes. And he said, either go in voluntarily or I'll section you. So I went in voluntarily. I went in voluntarily with 9 brandies in a glass.
You might as well make an entrance.
So I cried for 3 days and couldn't understand what was happening. Why couldn't I feel loved? Why didn't people take care of me rather than being aggressive towards me? And, you know, it stands me in good stead now knowing what it's like, because I don't want anybody ever to feel like I felt.
Yeah.
So it's really important that people get what they need. And over the years, my view on how to get people well has changed so dramatically. You mentioned the Priory. I was renowned at the Priory for being very incisive, but very in your face. And I don't regret that, but there's a better way of doing it.
In your book, Who Says I'm an Addict, which I would highly recommend, you said in there that when you was in the North London Priory group that you told everyone to call themselves an addict rather than an alcoholic or something else. Why was that?
Well, because addiction comes in people. It doesn't come in bottles or pills. And my experience is that if you have one, you know, I used to make a joke. You come in with one addiction and you get nine free.
Yeah.
Because, you know, people come in for alcohol. We get them detoxed. They start doing recovery. But they cross-addict without even thinking about it.
Now, I had a whole question about that cross-addiction, which I'd love to talk about, because when I was in there, Hilary Betts was there, and you'd be slipped a brown envelope to go and do SLA stuff.
Yes.
For those who don't know, it's sex, love, addiction. And I was thinking, I've been here for... I've done my 28 days, I'm doing another 28 days. I have no brown envelope. And then the morning came when I got a brown envelope. I was like, shit. And it was what you said. I came in here for one thing and now they're giving me loads of other, not realising that it's just uncovered, which is there. But I took tracksuit training gear because I thought when I'm there, all I'm going to do is run around the grounds, do loads of push-ups, sit-ups and just get super fit. And I wasn't allowed to do anything.
Mm.
And it was... mentioned cross addiction, which I had no idea at the time, which I know now. Could you tell us what cross addiction is?
Well, it's simply when you have one identifiable issue that's an addictive process, but having put it down, you move on to something else. So chapter and verse, if you go to an AA meeting for alcoholism, you walk through the door and the first thing you're confronted with is a load of caffeine and a load of sugar. Because people, you know, come in emaciated, and within weeks they've ballooned, because sugar takes over from alcohol, and sugar is probably the most mood altering substance on the planet.
Yeah. For more about what addiction really is, check out season 2, episode 5. Number 6, we hosted the very kind and wonderful Alistair Richardson.
My parents did the best they could with their history, their problems, their belief system, you know. And I think I said to you yesterday, I don't see myself as a victim of my trauma, because I think on a spiritual level, I chose it to prepare me for this work that I do, you know. But saying that, it did harm me in my childhood, you know. So, for example, but when I was about 3, my dad was late home and I was saying to Mum, can I stay up? And she said, no, go to bed. And I had a tantrum and I said, oh, well, I'm going to kill myself then. And she goes, well, go on then. And I was like, huh? And then I'm going to throw myself in quicksand, go on then. So she kept saying, go on then, whenever I said I was going to kill myself. And I said, I'm going to throw myself out the window. She said, go on then. So I literally climbed on the window to jump out from the first floor when I was 3 or 4. And I thought then, bad idea, I'm going to hurt myself, so I didn't. But I took on a belief at that time, maybe, that my mum didn't want me to live. And when I was about 6, she took me to the morgue to see a dead boy my age. She was a doctor, and she never explained why. I know now she was really frightened I was going to die, because I would do really dangerous things, you know. I'd climb on roofs and, you know, because I think after my dad left, it was that I learned to do dangerous things to fix my feelings, to escape into fantasy. And then she took me to boarding school when I was 7, but she didn't tell me she was going to leave me there. You know, she said, come and see this school, see if you like it. If you like it, you can stay. And we went to the school, had a look round. I was fully expecting to come home. She says, do you like it? I said, yeah, but I don't want to stay. She says, well, you are staying and your bag's packed. And she just left me there. And at that moment, I didn't even know this till years later, that was the most traumatic part of that memory, when she told me, because she was the last person I trusted in the world at that point, and she just betrayed me and abandoned me, you know.
For more about what trauma really is and how to get through it, check out season 2, episode 6. Number 5, we have the very smart Yasmin.
Glad you asked about America. I think things would have been very different. If I would have stayed in the UK, I would have quickly started going to pubs and drinking. But like you said, it's not accessible in California. So eating disorder developed as a way to kind of change the way I felt, because you couldn't get alcohol. You know, when I went to university at 17, I started. I got a fake ID and then I drank, and then again, it accelerated quite quickly. But in those couple of years in between, I didn't really, because it wasn't available. It wasn't the thing. So instead, I developed bulimia, which again, it's another way of changing the way you feel.
Yeah, it's another
way. It's an addiction, yeah.
Yeah, it's a food addictions or eating disorders are painful, aren't they? Because you have to eat.
Yeah. For me, though, I think it's slightly, I think I completely... relate to everything. But my sis had the opposite. She grew up with a very severe anorexia. And I think, you know, my father couldn't handle her eating, like the fact that she didn't eat, because it took the secret from outside, indoors to outside. You know, you can't hide a child who weighs 3 stone. And for him, that's very difficult to cope with. So he would make her eat, you know, he would force food into her mouth, and when she didn't, there'd be repercussions, you know. And I thought, well, if I overeat, then I'll get his attention, because I'm overeating. As a result, I turned into everything again he didn't want me to be, because he wanted his children to look perfect, and I became quite overweight. And
so sad when you're younger, though, that you have to. It's a desire. It's the desire to connect, isn't it, with your parents?
Exactly.
And so many people in the rooms of a 12-step program say that.
Yeah.
That all they want to have is a connection.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, when if you're given labels, we were given labels as children. So my sister was the beautiful one, because she had very angular features. I was the intelligent one, and my brother,
with angular features.
That's what I mean. My brother, he was the long-awaited son, you know, they wanted him from the first child. And so when you're given a label, on top of the fact you don't fill in, the only identity you have is that label your parents give you. And for me, it was always, I had to perform well at school. My sister had to look perfect, and, you know, but the labels would cross over. So for my father, if we didn't look the way he wanted us to, if there was any indication that there was problems or anything, we were told, you know, to be quiet. But if visually you're showing those things, you know, that's why it would never hit us on our faces, because it would show, you know. So it was always where it couldn't show.
To learn more about forgiveness and facing your past, see season 1, episode 7. Number 4 saw us go down the best kind of rabbit hole with Dr. Rayan Zafar.
I think a lot of our behaviours that we do, and specifically in addiction, is really about finding a way to cope. It's about using an external behaviour or substance to feel internally satisfied. And one really famous quote, I'm sure you know, is Gabor Mate asks, don't ask why the addiction, ask why the pain.
Yeah.
And almost all of these behaviours are really individuals trying to self-comfort something deeper, psychologically driven, that is causing them this unsettling feeling. And ultimately, drugs are very good at dampening that feeling down.
And they're fast acting as well, aren't they?
Yeah, if you have something that you've not dealt with, early life trauma, childhood adversity, it can be a plethora of things, those substances numb that emotional response, and exercise as well. It can blunt that emotional response. You're taken out of it. These things become coping mechanisms over time.
I'm convinced that there's a genetic part to addiction, because, and also in the 12-step community, we talk about it. Some people say they feel like they was born with it, yeah. And they feel like they was born with a couple of layers of skin less. They're more sensitive to situations, and the reactions are different from other people. And others are like, nope, I totally drank myself into addiction, or I totally used myself into addiction. Is there a genetic part?
Yeah, the simple answer is yes. The complex answer is that it's more than just genetics. So really fascinating study was done at the end of last year, University of Michigan, and they looked at 200,000 people and they measured their genes. And you can do this thing where you look at all of the different genes in someone's genome. So a gene is something that will describe what color eye you have. But in this case, they were looking at genes that might be related to addiction. And what they found is that there were 19 different genetic mutations that were significantly associated with an increased likelihood of having an addiction.
Wow.
So it's not one gene. So certain neurological conditions like Huntington's, you have one gene deficit and you definitely get the syndrome. Whereas with addiction, it's a bit more complex. About 40 to 60% of the explanation for the disorder is genetic. And that can be due to one of these or several of these 19 different genes that an individual has. And those genes code for different things in the dopamine reward pathway. So the pathways related to reward seeking or brain development. So that's one thing that we know, that there is this genetic heritability that you see. But beyond that, another really, really cool piece of research that was done is in this study called the ABCD study, and it tracks children's brains over time. 10,000 children, their brains are scanned at between 9 and 11 years old before they've even had a substance, and they scan them again at 15. And what they did was they separated the kids into two camps, those that had tried a drug by 15 and those that hadn't. And they found that at 9 years old, 9 to 11, you could predict which kids, based on the front part of their brain, the frontal cortex, the thinner the frontal cortex, the higher the likelihood they were to use drugs before the age of 15. So that shows in some people, they have this abnormality in brain structure that predisposes them to want to take drugs.
To learn more about genetics and the physiology of addiction, listen to Season 2, Episode 8. Number 3, we have the wonderful and wise Jim. Jimmy, for someone who's 45 years sober, what practices have you found in that period of time that keep you strong and keep you desiring to work in a 12-step program and stay sober?
What's kept me of getting to where I am now? You know that Star Trek, you know the opening gambit to Star Trek? Well, I was a Trekkie, right? And it says in the opening gambit, boldly go where no one's gone before.
Yeah.
Inner space. I took drugs to get out of space, out of my mind. You know, what I did with the 12 steps was to go inside, inner space. You know, so I went in, and I went into the realm of the magic, the Peter Pan, where I was lost. I lost myself in that. And then I went in and brought myself out of that.
Wow.
So it's about working. Boldly go where no one's gone before.
Inside.
Faced my fears.
Yeah.
And looked at all the things that I was misread. People told me, good for nothing, you won't amount to anything. And things like that. And as you know, I do carvings on sticks. And I do three faces. And these three faces that I call them, you know, love is one face. The second face is success. And the third one is wealth. Right? But, you know, if you just take the wealth, you'll only have wealth. If you just take success, you'll only have success. But if you take love into your life, you will be granted success and wealth.
Yeah.
Right? So that's what's kept me going. And I thought wealth was having a big house, fast car. Wealth is not nothing to do with that. Wealth is health. You know, so I'm wealthy because I'm healthy. You know, and it's successful. I haven't drank. To me, that's successful. And the reason I'm successful is because I've got love in my life. And love is God.
Yeah.
God is nothing more, nothing else, nothing like pure. Purity, pure love. Hate and love do not dwell in the same house. So that's why I know I'm not God. Yeah, and that's what keeps me going.
That's really beautiful, Jim. For those who are listening to the podcast, not watching on YouTube, your eyes are blue and they're glowing. If someone's listening and they are potentially going down the road of alcoholism or drug addiction, or they are already there, what advice would you give them?
Surrender. You know, you got to, and it's a, you know, when you think of it, you surrender to win. So I read that in the book, and it was, and I thought, how can you surrender and win? When you surrender, you lose. It's a paradox.
Yeah.
The moment I surrendered, I started winning. You know, and the difference is, you know, of, you know, a faith. You know, we all believe, you know, the sun comes up and goes down. You know, to test that is like you see the guy crossing the Niagara Falls on a push banner.
Yeah.
And you're seeing that, so you know he can do that. Faith is getting in the barra.
Yeah.
I get in the barra.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, let go.
If you want to find out why surrender is actually a strength and why a consistent spiritual practice can take you from dark to light, listen to season 2, episode 7. Number 2, we have the spectacular therapist Anita.
All the time I struggled. I really struggled in early days of sobriety because, you know, I'd had this sort of career and then I got sober and I had nothing. I was in Wilson County Court for taxes unpaid in the 80s. I didn't drive. I didn't have any money. I didn't have a partner. I didn't have anything. And all of a sudden people were telling me when I came into recovery and getting clean and sober to be grateful, you know, and I remember thinking, be grateful, yeah. Be grateful.
Do you know where I just come from? Did you not see my last job?
Yeah, and then having to go, and I remember in Kensal Rise, the health shop had a signed photo of me on their wall, and I went in there just to ask them for a job because I needed money. I had no money.
You must have felt, was that your emotional rock bottom? Like you felt like you just lost everything
was the end? It was, you know what, the lady who helped me said to me, you'll be really grateful that you've got all the time to work at your recovery and to focus on you getting well. And I remember thinking, she's mad. Why have I asked her? Because why would I be grateful for this? But she was right, because I was the type of person, when I look back, I've got high energy at times and I would be off. I'd be off. And what it made me do was really stay put and work at getting how to live in the world clean and sober. And I do believe from the age I started drinking and using, I stopped growing emotionally. So I was a 29-year-old with the emotional makeup of a 12, 13,
But that's a common theme, right? They talk about it in recovery, in the rooms that people share, that when they started to use drugs or drink or love addiction or food addiction, they stopped.
My experience is from myself and from working with other people that when people start really getting into recovery, they really feel they've sort of like regressed or suppressed both, really. The age, all of a sudden they're feeling, because most people feel lost when they first get sober. If you're really connecting with recovery, I think you really do, there's a sense of feeling lost. You might feel amazed. Like my first bit of serenity was sitting in Queen's Park with my flatmate and the dog and sitting there, and all of a sudden all those voices weren't going over in my head, you know, because if people asked me anything, I'd be second guessing them, what do you mean by that? And all of a sudden I was just sitting in the sunlight with, you know, and I had no money, I had no job, I had no relationship, I didn't have anything that would, other esteem that I talked about, I just was me. And for the first time ever, I remember having about 2-3 minutes of feeling okay, and I thought, I found out that's what serenity is, right? So to feel comfortable in your own skin.
To find out more about the gift of serenity, please listen to season 1, episode 6. And our number one top episode of all time is Michelle Heaton. About your upbringing.
Can you send me an email that's on how the direction might go for this interview? And one of it was paint a picture of your upbringing. I thought you meant paint a picture.
It was probably not clear if I was writing.
It wasn't clear at all. So I was like, I can't. I actually had a meeting last night. Anyway, I was sharing it. So I came this morning. I was like to your producer, I'm sorry, I haven't painted a picture. And she's like, what do you mean?
Oh, bless. Sorry about that, but I will ask you, what was it like to be brought up as a young Michelle in Gateshead with that dream?
I didn't have the best upbringing when it comes to, you know, money. You know, we had very, very little. I didn't know any different. I didn't go to stage school. I didn't have dancing or singing lessons. I just knew that I loved singing and that I wanted to perform. So music was a massive part of my upbringing. My escapism was with music. Whenever the radio was on, I'd imagine myself in a different place. I just felt like there was more, like I didn't quite fit in. And, you know, being sober for almost 3 years and talking to other people who have had addiction problems, they often feel like they don't fit in, or that they, you know, they're supposed to do something different, or that they didn't know who they were. And I definitely had that. I just knew what I wanted to do. And then I just set my sights on it. And I sang in every competition that I could go to. I went to auditions. And then along came Pop Stars after, you know, a number of years trying.
Was that 21?
Yeah, that's right. Well, 2000 was when Pop Stars, the TV show, was made. Yeah. And 2001, I can't even pronounce it properly. Look at us.
2021.
Oh my God, 2021. 2001 was when Liberty X started to make music.
So 2001 was when I was living in LA and I was on the last decline of my using.
That's right. So how long have you got in sobriety?
Soon I'll be 20 years.
It's amazing. Well done.
I know. It's really good stuff. I'm really happy about it.
Good. You should be. You should be. Because not a lot of people make that. You know, not a lot of people make what I have. I mean, coming out of rehab, we've lost one already who's gone, you know, died of an overdose.
It's usually one in three from rehab, isn't it?
Yeah.
When I was in there, they said, look to your right, look to your left. One of you is going to die.
Yeah.
One's going to have a rough time,
yeah,
and one of you will make it.
Yeah.
And I think I asked about the stats, and the reason being is because a lot of people go into rehab for a holiday
or a break. I saw that.
Oh, I'll just dust myself off and I'll go back out there and do what I was doing before.
Yeah, exactly. And there were people like that in there with me.
Yeah.
Usually like the younger ones, you know, whose family, you know, pay for it time and time again. And then they just see it as a get out of jail free card. But then there was a lot of people in there like me who was trying to live and not die.
For more of the episode, and there is a lot in there, Michelle is incredibly candid and honest about her journey through alcoholism and addiction, fame, and now to freedom. Please see season 1, episode 5. I hope you enjoyed hearing those moments. It's been so good to put these together, and we have many, many more episodes coming out. For season 6, we have something very, very exciting. We are taking you to the building site. We have painters, we have bricklayers, we have pipe fitters, we have tilers. These guys have been strong enough to face their problems and issues head on, work through them, and take other men on and help them as well to express themselves, to have group talks and conversations, which you can't do still today on a building site. I'd like to thank Shannon, our producer, Lewis Day to my right, who's the best engineer, my wife, Dr. Federica Amati, Emma for doing all the back work, and maybe me for being on the mic. Thank you.